Geburtsgeschichten. Ich bin Thea Mayer. In diesem Podcast erzählen Frauen von ihrer Schwangerschaft, der Geburt und dem Wochenbett.
Herzlich willkommen zum Geburtsgeschichten-Podcast. Heute gibt es eine Bonusfolge aus meinem englischsprachigen Podcast Birth Stories from Around the World. Und zwar ist das ein Interview mit Paul Golden. Paul ist Hebamme, Krankenpfleger auf der Neonatologie, Rechtsberater und Menschenrechtsaktivist. Und wir sprechen heute über das Thema Menschenrechte und Geburt. Viel Freude mit dieser Folge.
Welcome, Paul. I'm very excited to have you on the podcast today. Can you introduce yourself?
You're too kind. Lovely to see you, Tia, and everybody watching. Hello to you all. My name is Paul Golden. I'm kind of five things, many things. We all are. But I'm a midwife, a neonatal specialist nurse who worked in intensive care throughout my life, a naturopath, acupuncture and various other therapies, cranial sacral, shiatsu, which I teach. I'm a legal advisor and a mediator, as well as being an artist, musician, a parent, and all these other things that we all are. But that's the five kind of job things.
Amazing. A busy person, I would say. The first question I always ask all my guests on this podcast is, what do you know about your own birth and how you have been birthed into the world?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And I like to ask this to others, including like doctors and obstetricians, especially. So why are some people working one way, why another way? So I've worked a lot with natural birth because probably the story of my birth is I'm a twin born at home, not known to be twins. My mother had a 5-year-old, 3-year-old, 2-year-old. She's giving birth to me half an hour after I come, my twin brother comes. And we were both around 3+ kilos each, 6.5 pounds. And being told the story that that was normal, twins were at home, she was 41 weeks, that didn't even register with me. 41 weeks, okay, that's a number, that's normal. And here we are much later, and twins at home and 41 weeks. So my mother was also offered an anti-sickness drug during her pregnancy, which fortunately she declined. The name of that drug is thalidomide. And this, for people of my generation, resulted in many people losing their limbs when they were born, congenital abnormalities, no arms, no legs. So I'm very grateful to my mother, who had a very simple... She came from a simple Irish, very peasant, crofting background, you know, one room hut in a field, and she came to England. So that simplicity meant, although a lot of people just go along with the doctor offering them drugs, she trusted her body, and she was cycling to work in the bank, would stop, be sick, get back on the bike, carry on to work. And so I knew this as a story. Oh, birth is natural, normal thing. It can be this way or that way. So that probably affected why I particularly choose to normalize and look at the physiology of birth and say, well, you've got all the options you like, and keep it simple, keep it natural as far as possible.
Amazing. My next question would be, and that's half answered already, how did you get passionate about birth, about nursing, and then also the law aspect that you have?
So how did I get into all these areas of nursing midwifery? I think I was always interested in people. It's a natural thing to be curious. And I was focused on justice and injustice. Going through school years, I would stand up. I think as a child, nobody stood up for me. So I chose to stand up for others and then myself more. So we had a dysfunctional family. That's how it is for a lot of people. Parents divorced. So I studied law, looking at how to stand up for people. And then I went to India, lived a bit in the Himalayas with Tibetan families, and then saw the refugee situation of Tibetans moving out of their own home country into India. Learned a lot from them. Also then went into Pakistan, Afghanistan. This is in the 80s. And learned again from Afghan tribal people about refugee health and everything. Came back to the UK and did nursing, because I was focused on people. I could have studied medicine, but I thought I want to be by the bedside, 24-hour kind of work with birth, life, death. Now, birth was for women, not for men. And when I did intensive care work, I did adults first. Then I went to Australia. The only job I could get was children's intensive care, which was probably one of the best jobs I ever had. And we were developing cardiac surgery, heart surgery with babies at that hospital in Perth. And I studied a lot with intensive care, but I had to go and help with the premature babies in another unit next door. And I was terrified of these skinned rabbits that weighed, you know, 500 grams, even a 1 or 2 kilos seemed like a skinned rabbit, too tiny to touch. And I was terrified of this. And even when I had a big baby to bath, I was quite frightened of just the normal baby. But then it becomes familiar. And I love turning fear into excitement. That's a theme I've got in my life. So somebody could be afraid of going to court or whatever it is. And if we look at that, what is that? Be curious. And for me, that was excitement. When I came back to the UK to study midwifery, I'd gone and studied acupuncture in Sri Lanka and other Asian Oriental countries. And I came back to the UK. I did the midwifery, very inspired because the women's babies I'd been caring for kept asking me to be a midwife, to come to their births. And I thought, well, I can't do that. I'm a man. But when I was 15, my first sister had a baby. Then my next sister had another baby. And then they went on to have a few more babies. My best friend at college had a baby when she was 17. So I was familiar with babies in a personal way, just not in a professional way. Once I got comfortable with dealing with babies, actually pregnancy was, I felt it was just like talking to my sisters, to talk to pregnant women. They would open up and tell you all the details about their birth, pregnancy, what was good, what was not good. And a common theme was that the women in the hospitals caring for them were quite often very bullying and, you know, maybe matriarchal. Some loved a woman who would slap them on the legs and tell them, get on with it. And they would come back to that midwife for their next baby. I really couldn't quite understand that relationship. Everyone's got choices and it's wherever the woman feels safe. So I came into it through a mixture of kind of law, philosophy, spirituality, being with Tibetan Buddhist culture, Hindu culture, Muslim culture. I grew up with the Catholic culture. So it just all focused down to people and what could I learn and share with people.
I absolutely love that. And I just wrote down, turn fear into excitement. And I just thought like that, that's it for birth. Like we need to shift from fear in our culture to excitement around birth.
If we do it with everything in life, you know, if we were standing on the edge of a cliff and maybe we're going to fall off or maybe we are falling and we're frightened, why be frightened? Just turn it into excitement, even if it's your last second on earth.
Enjoy the fall.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Today, I would like to talk to you about the aspect or like the intersection of law, of women's rights and birth. And there was a case a few years ago, in 2010, actually quite a few years ago, 15 years ago, before the European Court of Human Rights, which was the case Tarnowski versus Hungary. Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about that case and what maybe the theoretical implications are of that? Because I know that in practice, women still suffer around childbirth. And I mean, the midwives as well as the women's, they have to fight for how and where they want to give birth.
Okay. And I'll come back to that word fight at the end of this. There is a right to private and family life. We all have it. We shouldn't have to have laws to be kind to each other. How would we like to be treated is how we could treat others. But fear gets in the way. So a lot of hospitals, institutions are frightened of giving people too much choices. They make bad choices. They think they're uneducated, not like the people in the hospital. We're educated, so we should make choices for others. But we don't live with the consequences of their decisions. So the case in Hungary, Anna Tarnowski, who I've spoken to recently, and I met her at the conference in The Hague in Netherlands that was about 10 years ago, the Human Rights in Childbirth Conference, set up by a wonderful person, Hermine Hayes Klein. She's in America now. So this conference was also looking at this case. So Hungary was not really providing choices. It was penalizing women, not providing the options for home birth. And when a midwife was brave enough to do home birth, it happened to be Agnes Gerib. She had very many home births and very few poor outcomes. Poor outcomes could be a stillbirth, baby dies before the birth, at or during or after a birth. And the number one cause of these deaths are congenital abnormalities. So the baby would probably in most cases die, whether it's in hospital or out of hospital. So it's not really about a safety thing. You know, which is safer? We know from research in many cases, home is safer than hospital. And whether we're looking at short-term or long-term. So if the short-term is, let's save you and the baby now. Ah, but we put a scar on the uterus and that puts you at risk later. You know, so there's different kinds of risks to evaluate. Tarnovsky was a token case. Anybody, a man even, could have taken this case and said the state is failing to provide choices in childbirth. It's failing to provide for a midwife to come to your home. And the ruling by the court, to keep it quick and simple, is very simple that they said, yes, the state has an obligation to provide not only the choices, but it must provide the mechanism. That is, it must provide the resources. So it should be funding midwives. In some countries, you have a hospital midwife who can go out into the community, work at a home birth, and there's no distinction between the two. In New Zealand, almost half the midwives work independently. In the UK, it's a very small percentage, but a lot of the government midwives can go out go to home births. And in the Netherlands and Scandinavian countries, to some limited and variable extent, there aren't any rules saying who can do what. You can just go to a home birth. But some of the less developed kind of Iron Curtain countries or ex-Iron Curtain, so Eastern Europe, they would want to impose you must have a license for 5 years before you can go to a home birth. But all you're going to get is often very bad practice for 5 years before you're allowed to go to home birth. So there's no rationale. We need to challenge the rationale. It's a very wide law, this right to private and family life. It can be used too widely, some would argue, but it gives us the choices in childbirth, the right to go to court in our domestic court. You must exhaust all the national courts before you can go to the international court, the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg in France. So we took a case in Bosnia where a woman I cared for had a home birth, made a BBC documentary, and we highlighted that that country does not provide any midwives, that the hospital system is so based on fear and autocracy, that is an authoritarian hierarchy of you must get on the bed, you must have a cut vagina, we will pull the baby out, we will push the baby out with this fundal pressure. And that's the norm. And then you go over the border into a more developed country. To some extent, Austria is a more developed country. The reason I say to some extent is it's incredibly backward and medieval, Austria and most of Europe, because they're based on what they call tradition, which comes from religious belief. And that religious belief has been swapped over to medical belief. Instead of show me the evidence and I'll make up my mind and I'll take the consequences of my decision myself. We're not having a doctor monitor us when we're making love. So why do we need monitoring in a hospital when we're giving birth? It's an intimate thing. We just need to feel safe. But we've hypnotized many of ourselves into feeling safe in an alien environment, the hospital instead of the home. So generally, home birth is safe for over 95% of the population. If you've got cardiac, respiratory problems, blood clotting problems, you need medical help. If you have a car crash, you need medical help. If the birth has a surprising element to it, we need medical help. But this is less than 5%. And if I'm wrong, the maximum 10%. So that means 90% of people could be birthing at home. And our grandmothers were, and my mother certainly was. It wasn't a hippie choice. It was the baby's coming. That's it.
Yes, I mean, that's a very good point you made there in the end, that just two generations ago, it was normal to birth at home. I know that in my own family, in my maternal line, the last home birth that took place was in 1927. That was my grandmother who was born at home. And then after her, everyone birthed in the hospital until I birthed at home again with, you've mentioned it before, a scar on my uterus because I had a previous cesarean and then chose home birth. So even that is safe. But in most countries, even in Austria, where home birth is legal generally, having a home birth after a cesarean is very tricky and a quote-unquote risk. I think we could talk about that one case for a really long time, but I would like to move on because 4 years after that case, Janowski versus Hungary, which in my mind, in my opinion, makes it very clear that every woman, every family has the right to choose wherever they want to birth and who they want to have at their birth. There was another case before the European court, Dubska versus the Czech Republic, where they recognized that Article 8 protects the women's right to make a choice about childbirth, but found that the Czech government was entitled to decide whether or not to support women's choice of home birth by allowing midwives to attend them. What do we think about that?
I think it's unclear. It's ambiguous. And it's very arrogant. And why not? I think the judges got it wrong. Not whether it's arrogant or not. Worse than that, it's a form of stupidity. Those judges will have daughters, granddaughters, wives, sisters, relatives in their community who are going to give birth. And they haven't thought this through. It can be challenged in the Czech Republic. They're trying to introduce other restrictions on home birth. And at the moment, they've got a very confused system. And Czech used to be part of Czechoslovakia. So you've got Slovakia doing something quite different. Why have we got these differences even between Austria and Germany? You speak the same language. You have similar shared cultural histories in some aspects. And yet in different parts of Europe, like in Germany, they're having home breech births as a norm. They're having breech birth in hospital as a norm. That's just focused on breech. But also after that case, there was a case about Croatia, where in Strasbourg, the same judges did not really support the right to private and family life. So that's a failing by those judges. What we need is 100 cases. When we have one or two, people saying, ah, but this happened. We need it to become a norm. If we normalize taking legal action, now, for example, the Hungary case cost 100 euros to the lawyers to prepare it and zero to file it. It is free to file a case in Strasbourg in the European Court of Human Rights. And they go from the papers. Nobody turns up and argues the case. No lawyers have to turn up. Get somebody to help you with the statement and you send it in. But you can only do that when you've gone through your own domestic courts. So we should be having very many more cases. And this is something I want to share and explore in this podcast with you, is why we don't take action in our lives. What is the motivating and unmotivating factors? Because it's very simple to write on a piece of paper, I had a traumatic birth. This happened on this date, time, place, and it was wrong. They pushed on my belly. They cut me. They didn't need to do that. Here's the research. Here's the evidence. And get a ruling in the domestic court. And if it doesn't work, go to the international court. Equally, birth attendants like midwives, possibly doulas, can say, I witnessed a terrible violent, obstetric violence. And in fact, there is just violence. It's not whether it's obstetric violence, something else.
Can I just add to that, you just mentioned doulas and midwives can do that. Also, fathers, male birth partners
Absolutely.
Can do that.
Yeah. I am a father and I see fathers, some midwives, they love being a woman and they fight for feminists and women's rights. And when they meet a couple, some midwives just don't even see the man. They don't look at him. They don't include him. They don't understand he's a co-parent. He will be sleeping next to his wife for the rest of their lives. And if she's depressed and traumatized from the birth, it affects the whole family. So we must think, and I think grandparents, the extended family, some culture, when I lived in New Zealand half my life, they're very focused on the large extended family. In India, their extended family is everything. And when Indians come to live in England or Europe, they have better mental health because they generally have extended family. The white Western person who's isolated themselves with their money and their economy focus has worse mental health problems, particularly postnatal depression. So yeah, fathers can take action. Midwives do this. There is even secondary psychological trauma, psychiatric trauma rather. So if you see a road accident, you could be traumatized by it. You can't claim unless your proximity is very close. If that was your relative in the road accident and it affected you, you can claim. So if you're at a birth and your partner's traumatized or your baby, you can make a claim. It isn't about making claims and winning money. It's standing up for rights. When we fail to stand up for the rights, we don't have any. And there's such a famous poem from Auschwitz where whatever the man was, a communist, when they came for the Russians, I didn't stand up for them because I'm not one of them. When they came for the Jews, I didn't stand up for them because I'm not one of them. When they came for me, there was nobody left to stand up for me. So we are all failing to stand up for ourselves and each other. And we need to go into ourselves. What is it we're afraid of? Can we turn that fear into excitement? Write it on a piece of paper and burn it. Don't even send it, but take an action with ourselves. And some of us will step outside and be comfortable with the cause, or have a friend who's comfortable with the cause and say, I'm standing up for my rights.
My question then would be, because I would like to kind of like take you back to the beginning of what you were saying. You're just like saying, make a claim. And when you say that, it sounds very easy. For me, as someone who's never been involved in a legal case, I wouldn't even know where to start. Like, how, if I'm just a person without a lawyer, how would I even file a case?
Let's start at the end. Focus on what you would like. You could write that down. And you could, if I suggested to a group, if I'm teaching, and say, write down three things that you would like, two things about your life and one thing about birth. So you might say, I'd like a big house, I'd like a horse, I'd like a Ferrari, whatever you'd like. I'd like a husband, a wife, 10 children. Okay, now what would you like with birth? I'd like birth to be holistic, a choice where I can choose who is with me, where I am, and how I birth. Okay, what would that look like? How? So just go through the six questions of how, who, why, what, where, when. When you've had something done that you didn't like, the same six questions. This happened at this place, date, time with these people, what they did, why they did it, or why you think they did it. What was wrong with that? So you've got the facts and you've got the law. Then you apply the law to the facts. So the law is, I have a right to private and family life and it was breached. It's that simple. I have a right to bodily autonomy, integrity. Somebody touched me without my permission. That's assault and battery. The fear of the touch is the assault. Battery is the actual touch. It's also trespass to the person. Oh, they touched me in my vagina. And I said, no, stop. And they carried on. And they put some surgical instruments inside me. That's sexual violation. And they pulled my baby out. And then if the mother or the baby died, that's manslaughter. Nobody's taking a case for it. It seems easier to take a case for murder, as we have the case in England of Lucy Letby, than it is to take a manslaughter case. But again, it's our failing to challenge. Now, again, you could write all this and never send it anywhere. You could write it and then send it as the draft to the opposing party, being the hospital, probably, or the government or whoever. And you can say, this is a draft. I'm inviting you to have a conversation for us to collaborate and discuss and improve things. But it could go to court if you don't engage with me. Now, how many times they get a court form is very rare, and they're more likely to either run away, possibly engage if they have to. So we've got a phrase that you get mediation with the threat of litigation. I'll reverse that. The threat of litigation going to court gets mediation. So when I go to talk to the boss of a hospital and they like, no, go away, I fill in a court form, give it to them. They're like, can you come and talk to us today? We don't want to go to court because they're afraid of embarrassment and the cost of money, time, resources. And as soon as you start a process, things you cannot imagine come along to help you. If you decide to walk around the world or cycle around the world, that first step, the second step, the next step, people will come on your journey that help you that you could not imagine before you started. When you start a legal process, it will unfold. It could finish badly. You don't have to invest cost and money and emotional attachment. I'm suggesting people only do something that's exciting. They turn it into fun. life is fun. So your house is burnt down, half your family's died. It's not fun. But what you're going to do next is creative. I'm going to live. So you celebrate, I'm alive. Well, what can I do? And you stand up for yourself. We're always going to get knocked down. Things happen. We just get up again and celebrate what we have. It's life.
Thank you, Paul. So what I take away from that is that, because I think in my mind, you always needed a lawyer and a lot of money to actually start a legal case. And you're shaking your head right now and saying, no, that is not necessary. And I really like what you said about the option of mediation before going to litigation. And I mean, if mediation doesn't work or is not enough or not satisfying, you can always take the step of litigation afterwards.
Yeah. Mediation, in another word, is communication. Let's say we have a fight in the family. You disagree with your partner in the morning and one of you refuses to speak to the other one for days, weeks, months. But at some point, hopefully, in a family, you resolve things because you're there with each other. You have to communicate. Most likely what happens in the morning is resolved by the evening because of communication, proximity. In a hospital, I see people saying, I don't talk to that person because I don't like what they did 5 years ago. And they're still stuck in a different camp because they don't have to communicate always. So mediation, communication is a wonderful thing. We just need to invite people. We can't force them. And what we do is show a worse alternative. That's okay. You don't have to talk to me. But if you don't talk to me, it does mean we'll be going to court and then everything will be public. Whereas if you talk to me, we could actually keep it confidential. So you've got to show them a worse alternative and a motivation. And somebody says, I'm never going to talk to you. The same thing would apply if I'm asking, please don't cut the baby's cord. Of course, I'm going to cut the cord. That's what we do. So you just get a bit of momentum by saying, well, could you just leave it 3 seconds and don't cut the cord for 3 seconds? Could you leave it? So instead of a negative, don't cut the cord for 3 seconds, can you leave it for 3 seconds, which is a positive? And somebody says, I refuse to talk to you. Say, that's okay. I understand you're not going to talk to me. But what would it take for you to agree to meet with me and bring a friend with you? Oh, okay. Somebody who's just said an absolute no, like they're always cut the cord or they're not going to meet you, can shift. And it does shift. That's why mediation gets massively good results. And it doesn't have to be a third party mediator. To some extent, we can mediate ourselves. It's better having a third party mediator. There's costs and it's complex to get someone, but we can approach things ourselves like, I really want to help you because I want to get what I want to get, but I'm not going to get it if I don't give you something. How can I help you? By giving you something, what would you like? I want this. I can give you a small part of that. Could you shift and give me a small part? So it is kind of becomes negotiation. It blends negotiation, advocacy, and mediation. It's all about communication.
Yeah, you mentioned that word advocacy there, which I really like to think about. For me, I mean, I am a birth worker. I support parents before and after birth as a doula. I'm not attending birth, but I'm working with families around birth, but I'm also a mother. And I would really like to bring that kind of a consumer advocacy to the conscience of more people. Like, we have a voice as consumers consuming birth services, whether in or out of hospital.
You're absolutely right. It's important to focus that we are consumers. We've paid taxes. So even if we're getting free healthcare, it's not free. We paid for it. Even if we've moved countries, it's symbiotic. We paid in another country, so we're in this one. It's reasonable for us to get the free healthcare. The problem with advocacy for some people is they often use the word fight. I'm fighting for women's rights. I'm fighting for whatever. As soon as we're fighting, we've lost because we're having an opponent we're pushing at. Kind boundaries work. Unkind boundaries do not work. So I have an identical twin. He's part of me and not me. He's the person I've fought the most with throughout my life. I'll have a partner in my life who I might find irritating, difficult, and I'm fighting with them and it doesn't work. And it's really to do with I'm fighting myself. So as soon as we stop the fight and be curious and compassionate, looking at Gabor Mate's work, just be very kind to ourselves and practice self-kindness. And when I listed all the things I do, the number one thing I do is nothing. I will take time to do nothing and be conscious of breath, of awareness right now. And then I might go and do a legal case. I might be at a birth. I might be helping a baby with a problem. Then I all the time checking, am I in balance? So when we're fighting a case, we're going to lose. The whole art of war from Sun Tzu philosophy is very much like that. So I cannot push against a closed door. I have to get that person to want to come with me. If they don't, I say, okay, let's get clarification from the court. So I'm seeking it in a clarification way. If I record a meeting, it's for clarification. It's not for defense and offense. And I'm not sure if I make this point very clear to people. People are often puzzled. They always talking about fighting a case against the employer, the regulator, the government. They are us. My twin is me and he's not me. So if I want to fight somebody, and I was literally pushing people out of a room in India where they were being very mean to the woman and her baby. And I said, come back, we should be more kind. As I was doing it, I realized I have to be more kind. I cannot force others. So it's our own journey of kindness. Yes, have boundaries, have kind boundaries. We don't need to fight anything. Just stand up for our rights, saying, this is my right, I'm going to do it. And the weird thing is when somebody says, oh, you can't do that, why some people go along with that and others ignore it and go and do what they want. So why is some people so motivated to get the birth they want and others, all of us, myself included, will often play the victim role? What does it take for us to come out of that role and simply don't even have to stand up for our rights and say it, just do it? I call that primal birth. So I have people around me who just give birth, get the baby, and maybe I'm around, somebody is around nearby, but they trust themselves so much that they can just do it themselves. And those children grow up like thinking like the mother with great autonomy. I can do anything. I'm amazing.
Yeah, I really like that thought of not fighting against, but standing up for myself or for what I believe in. I think that's a beautiful note to end on. Before we go, Paul, where can people connect to you?
My email, midwifemediator@gmail.com. And if they search on Google or YouTube, LinkedIn for those that have it, and Facebook also, I'm on that.
And I will put all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time today, Paul.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast with Paul Golden. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please leave me some stars or a review and subscribe to this podcast so that more people will find it on their app. This podcast is still brand new and a baby, so I need a bit of support. So if you could just take a minute to review and subscribe and maybe send to a friend, that would be greatly appreciated.